Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, Harold Felder, and today the topic is the argument for God based on beauty. Now, I've done a number of topics on proving the existence of God, from the cosmos to intelligent design, but this is a very rarely heard argument. But today, that's what we're going to talk about. And to talk about this with me, I have Michael Spiker. Let me tell you about Michael. Michael has an undergraduate degree in biblical studies from Zion Biblical Institute. He has a master's of arts in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary, and he's been a speaker at the National Apologetic Conference. As a matter of fact, you spoke there on the topic of beauty, so you're qualified to speak on beauty. Matter of fact, we've done a show on nothing but beauty, and that was very enlightening to me. So hopefully now I have a better understanding of beauty. Well, let's just get right to it. Did I leave anything out, first of all?
No.
Is there anyone you'd like to say hello to? You're not married, so I guess you don't have to worry about it. See, I always tell my guests that because a lot of times, you know, they forget to mention their wife and kids, and I try to help them out, but...
I guess I should at least say hi to my mom and dad.
Okay.
Hello.
All right. That's good. Okay, then. The first thing I guess we got to do is, before we make the argument for God based on beauty, I guess we have to set a foundation here. We have to talk about what is beauty. So, Spiker, first of all, your name is Michael Spiker, but everyone calls you Spiker. So, if you hear me calling him Spiker, it's because I'm just used to calling him Spiker. Spiker. What is beauty?
Well, as we talked about in last show, the idea of beauty is different a lot of times when we're talking about it in this way than when we talk about it just in our experiences, because beauty oftentimes in our culture is a very emotional term. But as we mentioned before, the Greek word for beauty is kalos, which means good or beautiful, and it had to do with the idea of being well-formed and well-made. So therefore, a building that is structurally sound but may not be necessarily pleasing to the eye could be considered beautiful in that aspect of it. And then St. Thomas Aquinas came along, and he kind of had his definition of beauty, which
explain
is...
Explain who St. Thomas Aquinas is for those who didn't see the show on beauty.
He was a Catholic philosopher and theologian from the 13th century, and he came along and he said that beauty is that which pleases when seen. And what he means by seen there is when it's contemplated, not just glanced at. And then Mortimer Adler... expanded it a little bit further by saying that beauty has two aspects, the admirable and the enjoyable. The admirable has to do with the objective qualities, the qualities of the object, and the enjoyable has to do with your experience of that object. So something that is admirable ought to be enjoyable, but something that is enjoyable doesn't necessarily have to be admirable, if that makes sense.
Right.
Or if that just makes it muddier.
Well, I do want to summarize, because I think I've learned some things from you about what beauty is. So I'll summarize it for those of the audience who are not philosophers. And basically, one of the things that you made the point of about beauty is that beauty is objective, and beauty actually lives in a thing, regardless of whether or not we recognize it as beautiful. A person is beautiful even if I don't recognize it. Because whether or not I like something is separate than whether or not it's beautiful. Whether or not I like something or whether or not for instance, a woman attractive is because I have a taste, because of my particular taste. But it has nothing to do with the fact whether or not she's beautiful. Because she can be beautiful and I may not feel that attraction to her, because she could not be beautiful and I could feel attraction to her. Because one of the things you did was you separated and you made a distinction between beauty and taste.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I wanted to mention. So then let's go on to the next question. Is we're talking about God this time, so is God beautiful?
Yes. the first way to just really clarify that is from Scripture, especially in the Psalms. Whenever it talks about the glory of God or the splendor of His majesty, it uses terms like that all throughout the Psalms.
Yeah.
A lot of places in the prophetic literature as well, but especially the Psalms talk about that. And I have written down Psalm 27, verse 4. It says, it's a very familiar verse too, "One thing I have asked from the Lord that I shall seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to meditate in His temple." And I like this verse in particular because it kind of deals with both aspects of Thomas Aquinas' definition, that it's beauty is that which pleases when seen, because he's not only talking about that he wants to behold and see the beauty of the Lord, but he wants to meditate on it in his temple. And I thought that was kind of interesting that verse focuses on both those aspects.
Yeah, but here's a problem I have. The psalmist talks about wanting to behold the beauty of God. Throughout Scripture, it talks about God being beautiful. But throughout Scripture, it also talks about God being spirit, God being immaterial. How can God be beautiful if he's immaterial, if he's a spirit? How can something we do not even see or cannot even see be beautiful?
First of all, if God is the creator, as we believe he is, then if God created beauty, he would have to have it in order to give it away. So that's one way of looking at it. But a lot of people still understand, well, I can't see God. I can see a painting.
Right.
I can see the sunset.
That's how I know a painting is beautiful, because I can see it, because it has, we were talking about, mm-hmm. you were saying some of the things about beauty is that it has symmetry, mm-hmm. that it has form, you know, it's in a nice form. You were saying, for instance, like a person wouldn't be beautiful if it was missing an arm. Because these are quantifiable. These are things I can see. I can't see God.
It is a little bit more of a difficult thing because you can't see him. Now, first of all, you can see his effects. You can see that he created the sunset. And if that's beautiful, how much more beautiful would God be? So that's another way of looking at it. But then also, an article I read talking about the idea that God is beautiful talked about that God is the ultimate source of unity without monotony and variety without chaos.
Because explain that a little bit.
The Jews in the Old Testament would quote what's called the Shema, yeah. which says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one."
Right.
So he is the ultimate unity, but he's not, there's no monotony in God because he's perfect. So monotony would imply that God was lacking something. And there's diversity and variety in God in the sense that he dwells in three persons, but there's not chaos. So that's what that statement means. Unity without monotony and variety without chaos.
Okay, because when I'm thinking of beauty, I'm just thinking of something that has material and I can look at it. But you're saying that beauty doesn't necessarily refer to something that has materiality. It can just be something that more than just the thing of itself, something about the thing, I guess.
Well, for example, too, a mathematical equation for the mathematician is a beautiful thing. Now, you and I, because we're not mathematicians, might not have any idea what that even means, but that equation can exist in his head. So it doesn't have to have a tangible existence. But it can still be beautiful. So that's another way of looking at it, too, that things without matter can still be beautiful because a mathematical equation or a perfect logical formula can exist in someone's mind, and therefore it doesn't have matter, but it's still beautiful.
Okay. But you said that one of the reasons we know that God is beautiful is that he gives beauty to other things. So if he makes something beautiful, then he can't, like you said, you can't give what he does not have. But then, is God ugly? Because I've seen some things that are around. I'm not going to mention anybody's name, but that would seem, if you're using that same argument, that would imply that God, I could just as easily say that God is ugly.
Okay. It depends on what standpoint you're coming from, but for the philosophers like Thomas Aquinas and some of his disciples and followers and the modern day followers of his system of thinking, ugliness is not a thing in itself. Ugliness is the lack of beauty. So if God is the supreme source of beauty, everything below that starts becoming more and more and more and more ugly.
So there's hierarchies of beauty.
Yeah, exactly. If ugliness is a lack of beauty, then by saying that God could possibly be ugly would be saying that God could possibly lack something and really isn't perfect. So if God is perfect and infinite, then he is perfectly good and perfectly beautiful. And then you can just follow it down all of his attributes as well.
So the point that you're making then is that everything that God has created has beauty in it.
Mm-hmm.
Different levels of beauty. So a rose is higher on the beauty scale than a garbage heap.
Mm-hmm.
But a garbage heap has beauty in it. It's just not as much beauty as the rose.
Because typically, when you think of a garbage heap, now I know there's other things around, the things that we throw away, I know a lot of times, I'm not talking about senseless waste, but things that we actually throw away don't usually have their proper form anymore. That's why they're ugly and considered trash.
Oh, okay.
Because,
okay.
Like a stereo that works well, back on the Greek definition, that's well-formed, well-made, it works properly, it's functional, is beautiful in that sense. But when it stops working and it breaks, then it ceases to be as beautiful.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. Here's another analogy I just thought of. If I have a shirt, a really nice shirt, and I like wearing it, it's beautiful. But then if I spill something on it, if I get paint on it or something, I can't get it out, then I throw it away. It is no longer beautiful.
Yeah. And you could still say that it's only lacking in beauty in that one area where you spilled something.
Right.
Like the rest of it could still be considered beautiful. And it still would be considered beautiful in a sense that it might be well made. It might be a sturdy shirt or whatever.
Right. And another thing that I did want to touch on also is that we know that God is beautiful because that is actually an attribute of God.
Mm-hmm.
So just like God is all-knowing, all-powerful, wise, he's also beauty. He doesn't just have beauty. Actually, he is beauty.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I meant to say this, actually, but when you first asked me for this show, what is beauty?
Yeah.
One book I was just kind of reviewing some things in recently actually said the proper question should be, who is beauty? Because God is beauty. He doesn't possess beauty.
Explain that to the audience, how that works. I know it's complicated.
God being perfect, I'm trying to think of how to not use philosophical terms here.
Yeah, that's what's going to be really difficult.
God being perfect is beauty. He is goodness. He is truth. Whereas we simply possess or have beauty. We have truth because, okay, I guess I think the way to explain it is because God cannot lose those qualities. We can.
Here's another one. What about, let me know if I'm wrong because you're a philosopher here. Because God can't have parts, because he's a spirit, he can't have parts.
Uh-huh.
So then he can't be, part of him can't be beautiful. If he's beautiful, then all of them must be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever he is, all of it must be, God must be it in itself because he doesn't have a part over here that's beauty and a part over here that's wisdom.
Yeah.
But he's everything. I mean, so all of them has to be wisdom. All of them has to be beauty.
And because he cannot not exist, if that makes sense.
It makes sense to me.
Right. But now, since we can all of a sudden not exist, or we could kind of getting back to also what you said with parts, we could be the most beautiful person in the world, physically speaking, and then get burnt by a fire, and then all of a sudden we're deformed a little bit. Now, that doesn't mean we still couldn't be a beautiful person on the inside. Our shape has taken a different form. Therefore, just physically speaking, we would be less than, we would be lacking something that would normally make us beautiful.
Right. Explain what the beatific vision is and how that is related to the beauty of God.
All right. The beatific vision in a lot of scholastic philosophy and just a lot of Christian philosophy in general is seeing God in all of his glory. And therefore, what this does, and this is all theory. This is nothing that's directly presented in Scripture. There are some scriptures that have been used to argue for this, but this is kind of taking what we do know and trying to figure out what's going to happen later on. So it's still very theoretical. But what it means for a lot of Christians as thinkers and philosophers and theologians is that once that completes our salvation and our transformation. Once we behold God in all of his glory, that is what finalizes our salvation in him. It's kind of confusing. It's kind of difficult to understand because it's theory. But really, the beatific vision is simply seeing God in all of his glory and splendor. And what that means for us is that is our final resting place. That is our final. That is our goal in life. All the beauty. It's kind of like the verse that says, "Right now we see through a glass darkly.
Right.
Once we see that, we will see everything clearly, as clear as you know we could guess that we could see, still being creatures that are not necessary that could die."
Now, let me know if I'm right where I'm going with this. But
okay,
here's another thing. I my understanding about the beatific vision is that if I were to die right now and I went to heaven, I would get the beatific vision. I would see God for who he is. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't have eyes because I wouldn't have my resurrected body yet because that's still in the ground, but I would be spirit. So when I see God and see his beauty, I would be seeing it, but not through eyes. I think that's one of the things that we forget is that we understand through the senses. Mm-hmm. We know things through the senses. We know that something is beautiful because we can see it with our senses. But this is something, this is a knowledge that we will have that would be intuitive. This is a knowledge that we will have that will come directly from the mind of God. So I would be able to apprehend God as beautiful in a way I can never apprehend him physically. Mm-hmm. Because physically, I can't know God the way I would know him spiritually, because now I'm dependent upon my eyes and because this materiality, whereas at that point, I won't be.
Well, especially since there has to be something that God allows us or gives to us or something when we would view that, because I mean, it says in the Old Testament that whoever sees the face of God will die.
Right.
So there has to be something, some ability or whatever you want to call it, that makes us, that enables us that point to be able to see God for who he is.
Yeah. I mean, and let's think about it. Like God, for instance, does not have eyes, mm-hmm. but he sees all. Mm-hmm. But he sees it, he just sees it in a different way. He knows things. I guess that's what God talks about when he says he sees a man's heart, whereas mm-hmm. we look upon one another and we just see with our eyes, and God sees, you know, completely differently. Because it's hard for us to imagine. I mean, how does God see me? How does he see me right here? He's definitely not seeing it through a pair of eyes. He sees it somehow differently. But however he sees it on at a deeper level than I could ever see it. So yeah. I just think that's deep. I just think that's really deep. So the next question. Explain the relationship between one's experience of God and one's experience of beauty.
I'd recently heard an artist give a lecture on his artwork, and he was dealing with the idea of experience. And he said, what is it about someone staring off into space and just looking and gazing at the stars that it just almost always, many of the great thinkers and poets and philosophers throughout the ages have written something similar to that, whether it be the sun or the stars or a beautiful landscape, and had almost a divine moment. And even people that don't even necessarily believe in a specific God have recorded ideas of that. And he said, well, basically, if you think about it, the staring off at a starry sky is looking at this black backdrop with little specks of white mixed in. He's like, well, why couldn't you have the same experience of looking at that as if you looked at a cork board with a bunch of pushpins in it?
Right.
He's like, what is it about that? He said, there's no way to really analyze that. And I thought about that, and I was thinking that that just proves the point even further, that every time we experience beauty, we're experiencing an aspect of the very nature of God. And I think that's what the experience is, and that's why the cathedrals were built the way they were. They had these tall, tall ceilings to kind of give you a sense of God's majesty and glory and his greatness by making them so high that you just could do nothing else but just stand in awe of how high the ceilings and structures were. And I think that's really, I think we've lost that in a lot of our church circles. I think we fail to realize that the building itself can enhance our worship. I'm not necessarily pushing for the worship and using icons in worship or anything necessarily like that. I don't necessarily have a problem with it either. But at the same time, I think we sometimes, a lot of times the church art program focuses so much on the music that we forget that there's a whole visual. When most people think of beauty, they think of visual things first. And yet, when we think of using art in church, we always think of the worship team and the music.
Yeah.
And I think we really lost that in the American church, especially. We lost the aspect of creating a visual atmosphere in our church to enhance our worship and to help us to enter into the experience of beauty and truth and goodness all in one full sweep.
Maybe God gave us beauty to draw us closer to him. Because, for instance, like you said, you cannot, for instance, stand on a mountaintop and look out over the valley and look at the sky above and not have a spiritual experience. I mean, it's impossible. So I think maybe that's a purpose of beauty. It's just to let us know that God exists and let us know how awesome and how powerful he is.
I think it's also a lost art, kind of like I was saying, but to kind of add one more thought to that. It's a lost art because everybody finds something in this world beautiful. And I think we've really missed out, especially in our apologetics, on the idea of beauty, because we've really focused so much on other things and forgot that this is a huge area that everybody in the entire planet thinks that there is at least something that is beautiful.
Right.
Even if you know, we may disagree about it, but nobody disagrees that there are beautiful things. We may disagree about which ones, but we're not going to disagree about that beautiful things exist.
Right.
And I think we've really lost it in our churches and our church experience.
Now, I'm sure we've been touching on it, we've been building on it, but just in a short statement, how does beauty prove the existence of God?
All right, let me make it my statement, and then I'll explain it.
Okay, all right. All right.
If beauty is objective, which is what we dealt with in the previous show, then God must exist. Beauty is objective, meaning it requires a standard outside of our normal realm of experience. Therefore, God must exist. Now, what this means is, okay, the first statement, if beauty is objective, then God exists. The reason why I argue that that's true is that beauty requires a standard outside of our minds and outside of our sphere of existence to relate to give it that standard. You can't have a standard within the thing itself. That wouldn't make any sense. The standard has to be outside of it in order to impose itself on it. Therefore, God, or you know, an agent, if you want to call it that, but something has to give beauty that standard. And then, you know, we don't have time to go into all the arguments on this show, but we did on the last show. Beauty is objective. It's not in the eye of the beholder. It is based on reality, which has its source in the ultimate reality, which is God. Therefore, God must exist because beauty has an objective basis. This is kind of an elementary argument at this point. I haven't been able to bring it up to the level that I need to at some point. But
okay, so basically, Mr. Vargas, if I could summarize it. Basically, since beauty does exist and it is objective, then there must be someone who gave it beauty.
Someone on which to base that standard.
Someone on which to base that standard.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
If there's a standard, there has to be. It's kind of like the maybe to put it in terms that people are more familiar with in apologetics is, if there is a moral law, there has to be a moral lawgiver.
Right.
So if there's a standard of beauty, there has to be someone or something that gave it that gave us that standard.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I'm using.
Okay.
I kind of think that the argument from beauty is kind of a cross between the argument from design and the argument from desire, because beauty has both objective and subjective elements to it. Now, the objective elements are the fact that the beauty of a thing is in the thing itself. The subjective elements are that we experience that and find it pleasurable. And as far as proving the existence of God, too, as far as the argument from desire, to sum up real quick, is we have various desires, hunger, thirst, and there are objects that can meet that desire. So our desire for something beyond us, there has to be an object that can fulfill that desire. And most artists are constantly striving for something, and it's mostly even a mystery to them. They're always striving for something in the way of perfection, and they often feel that they've never found it. Charlie Chaplin, one of the greatest filmmakers, I think in 1995 he was voted best filmmaker ever at that point. He, at the end of his life, after making hundreds of short films and almost 20 full-length films, he said, "I was always striving for something and I never felt like I ever achieved it." And so my argument there is that if we're striving for something beyond ourselves, that should lead us to God. If not, we're just wasting our time.
Right. That's a good note to end the show on. I know it's hard to believe that we've come to the end of the show, but this is the end of the show. I want to thank you, Michael Spiker, for being on the show and talking about the argument for God based on beauty.
I would like to. You asked me before about people I'd like to say hello to. I would like to just say hello to everyone that is watching from the Well Coffee House and Church. I wouldn't want to leave you people out of this. I know there's going to be a lot of people watching this that are either regulars at my coffee house or church members there.
Okay. Well, like I said, thanks again for being on the show.
Yeah.
That will end this edition of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
The preceding show has been sponsored by Giving an Answer with your host, H.C. Felder. So you can hear this broadcast as well as other episodes by visiting us online at givinganswer.org. You can also order a CD or a DVD of the studio recording by calling me at 704-248-7840. And remember, this show will only stay on the air if people continue to help us buy airtime. So I encourage you to consider making a tax-deductible financial donation to this ministry. That phone number again is 704-248-7840. And be sure to join me again next time on Giving an Answer.